That is the American Basque band Oshpa, with our first guest on today's show, David Romvet, playing the accordion. Decades ago, David was fortunate to marry into a longtime Wyoming Basque family, ranching family, and since then, David has pursued his passion for Basque music as completely as his passion for writing essays, poetry, and novels. He teaches in the MFA program at the University of Wyoming, and he served as that state's Poet Laureate from 2003 till 2011. I spoke with David earlier this week before he heads over to Elko, Nevada for the 34th National Poetry Gathering, where he will perform with his daughter, Caitlin. David Romvet joins the program now. Welcome, David.
Thank you very much.
Some years ago, you were lucky to have married into a Basque family. I wonder if you could explain what it means to be a Basque new person.
Oh, yes, there's a term in the Basque language, which is called euskera, which describes a person who learns the Basque language as an adult. And you may be a person who has simply moved, say, as an immigrant to the Basque country or into a Basque diasporic community somewhere in the Americas or in other parts of the world and learned the language. And in that case, you are called an Euskaldun Berria, which means a new Basque human being. A person born to the language, raised with the culture and language, would be called an old Basque person. So you could be a 5-year-old old Basque person and a 50-year-old new Basque person.
Oh, interesting. One of the things about Basque culture that has always, well, that I've admired from afar is their cohesion. Is that your experience of the Basque culture?
That would be a very nice and very positive way to put it. We talk about this with all kinds of people. Sometimes we say, is a community open or closed in some ways? Is it easy to enter or hard to enter? The Basque people have created a community over thousands of years that has in some ways been very insular, and putting it in a more positive light the way you did, it would be one that was simply very cohesive. And that's been, I think, partially because it's a culture that's been attacked many, many times. It's a small culture, has been throughout its entire history, but for one brief period in the 13th century when there was a Basque imperial kind of dynasty. But mostly it's been very small, and it's been in a place where other people have invaded and sought to control the lives of the Basque people. So they've pretty much protected themselves, I think, by being defenders of their own closed community. That's much less so nowadays because there's less pressure. This is my opinion now, less pressure on the culture. It's still difficult to be a small culture in the modern world. But there are protections for people. And, for example, the Basque Autonomous Government in Europe can now allow students to go to school in the Basque language, which was impossible during many, many years of the Franco government in Spain and has been impossible for over 200 years in France. You can, of course, learn the language privately, but you can't go to school the way we do in this country. We know that if we go to an American school, we will have the opportunity to learn in English. The same is true now in the Basque country. A student can learn in Basque. That's a big help, especially given what you asked about new Basque person. The definition is based on language. If you speak Basque, you're Basque.
Well, let's talk about the language a little bit. It's called euskera. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Hard word, isn't it? It depends. Sometimes euskera, sometimes euskara. It depends on the region of the Basque country you're in. But that's the name of the language.
Talk to me for just a moment in Basque. I'd like to hear what it sounds like.
Oh, baina nire izena David dut, hemen bizi naiz, Wyomingen, eta zurekin hitz egiten ari naiz. That basically just said, my name's David, I live here in Wyoming, and I'm speaking with you right now.
The language of the Basque people is a very distinctive language in the world, on this planet. Linguists call it an isolate language.
Yes, that's right, which means that as far as we know, there is no spoken family member for the language on Earth. We would guess, probably, that there must have been related languages once upon a time. And if you go to the very earliest records, when the Romans came into the Iberian Peninsula, in the 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th centuries of the Common Era. They made a few vocabulary lists, wrote a few things down, and even from that you can tell the language has changed quite a bit. It's recognizable, more so, say, than our language. You know, if we go back to the great epic poem Beowulf, it's incomprehensible to us. We would consider it to be a precursor of English, but no current English speaker could understand Beowulf. Basque has a little more continuity, and maybe because it was a language only in one place, so it didn't have so many influences that it was rocketing around and changing over the last 1,000 years.
Interesting. Now, does it take a different form than Latinate languages? I mean, in terms of declensions and conjugations and all of that?
Yeah, that's right. For example, it's a language that uses prefixes, suffixes, to do the work of what we do with prepositions and with definite articles. You know, there's no word the, there's no word in, through, of, about. All those are additions to existing words. So the grammar is quite a bit different, and the verb is utterly different than the way a Latin language would think of a verb. It's unbelievable how the verb in Basque can carry all sorts of information that we do with a bunch of explanation. Like, the verb can tell you whether a subject is singular or plural, what tense it's in, whether I am speaking to you or you are to me. That's in the verb, not in, I don't have to say you to me because the verb tells me that. It's quite beautiful and elegant and also rather difficult to learn.
Have you ever translated from English into Basque or vice versa?
Oh, I've done a little bit of messing around on my own, of course. We all do that when we're learning languages. But in terms of my work as a writer, you know, mostly people feel that it's not very wise to try to translate into a language that isn't your native language. Mm-hmm. So translators may work with 2, 3, 5, 10 languages into their native language, but rarely would we, like me, I would never try to publish a Basque poem that was translated from English. I would get a Basque native speaker to do that. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'd work together, you know. But I would translate from Basque into English, and have done that a little.
I'm wondering if your experience of Basque has affected your poetics. You are a poet, a novelist, an essayist. Has the language affected the way that you produce your art?
To tell you the truth, I don't think so. Maybe only because I'm old, and so I have so many years of working with my own language, and I really do think of the language as some degree as separate, although you might be leading to this. I often feel as though at some point all the languages start to feel like one big language, and it's just that some of our neighbors only use parts of it and others use other parts of it. Sometimes I'm befuddled, and especially, oh my goodness, in learning Basque in the southern Basque country, which is inside Spain, that means that the other large language right there is Spanish. And so you tend to use them a lot together. You know the way we have Spanglish in the United States?
Oh.
Because people will know both Spanish and English. You're in Colorado, right?
Yes.
So you have, I'm sure, a lot of Spanglish speakers.
Yes.
In your area.
Yes.
And in the Basque country, there are a lot of people who speak Spanish and Basque equally fluently, and they just talk about speaking Euskanyol, a cross of Spanish and Basque. And I tend, for example, if someone speaks to me in Spanish, I have to stop myself. I often answer in Basque, because it would be completely normal in the Basque country to have that happen, but not here. If a Mexican-American person speaks to me in Arizona or Colorado or New Mexico in Spanish and I answer in Basque, we're both up a creek, because that person's not going to know Basque. So I don't know about the effect on my work. I think I have a sense of what I try to do in my first language, and it's different. Though I actually have written some stuff recently where I incorporate bits of Basque into the English. I did that in a novel that I published a year or two ago, and I'm doing that now with some poems. So maybe you're correct, and it has an influence.
Oh, interesting. How about that? We're speaking, David, because you are performing. I don't know if that's the right word, but you're reading, perhaps, at the National Cowboy Poetry Gathering in a couple of weeks in Elko, Nevada, and the theme of this year's gathering is Basques. So I'm presuming that's why you're going. And tell me about what attendees at the gathering will see when they come to see you and your daughter.
Yes, I will be at the National Cowboy Poetry Gathering with my daughter. And the two of us perform Basque music together quite often. She grew up here, of course, was born and raised in Buffalo, Wyoming, and so has had some relationship to the local Basque community in that time. We will be there as part of what they're calling the theme of Basques and Buckaroos. Their hope is to highlight and bring attention to and help us to see clearly what exactly is the nature of life in the American West. They began very much as cowboy poetry almost entirely. Now I believe that it's a much broadened scope about what is this life in the West historically, what has it meant? Still rural life is a big focus, but Basque ranching in sheep country was often very different than cattle ranching in places where there were no Basques. So they're giving that attention to the event this year, and it mixes with the traditional focus on Anglo-American rural life in the West. But we will, for example, perform Basque music, talk about Basque culture. We'll work with other musicians and writers who have different kinds of centers of attention than we do to see what is the relationship between the work of Basque artists and the life of Basque people in the West and those who weren't Basque. It's really exciting to me, you know, to be able to go there and do this. We'll work in the Elko Public Schools several days, meeting students, talking about Basque history in the American West. We'll be part of group performances that include Basque dancers and a tradition, it sounds like you're interested in language, called Bertzolariak. And these are rhymed, sung, sort of poems, I guess, or songs. I'm not sure. They use a limited number of melodies, but they are very highly structured in terms of the number of syllables and lines, and they're competitive. Two people stand up, and they get given a topic, like it might be Basques and Buckaroos, and then one of them chants, sings, recites, and finishes the little form, and the next one goes and does it. Often the two kind of joke and make fun of each other a little bit. It's quite incredible, and there will be Bertzolariak at the Elko event, too. So it's going to be hard to know what people make of it since it'll be in Basque.
My understanding is that the national champion, the Basque champion of that, Bertzolari, is a woman, the first time that has ever happened.
Well, she is this year's winner. Yes, it's quite an incredible thing. Try to imagine in the U.S. that if people got up and recited poems and thousands of people came to see them in a hall and sit quietly and listen to them reciting these things back and forth, but they're all improvised. You can't have written them down in advance. And yes, the national winner of that, which was just this December, Mayalan is her first name. I can't remember her last name. I bet you have it written down there.
Not right with me, but I did see that name. Yes.
Anyway, she is the first woman to have ever won it, but not this year. She won it for the first time, 1989, 90?
Oh, wow.
Something like that. So, but she was the very first woman ever to win it, and she has continued to be a big part of that world and now has won it again this year. That's pretty cool.
That is very cool. Now, have you ever seen one of those contests in person?
Oh, yeah, a lot. I was in the Basque Country for the month of November, and that is the time when the preliminaries and semifinals and finals of it are going on, because it goes on for quite a long time. Starts in the late summer, early fall. And there are all these preliminary rounds around the country leading up to this final thing where the last eight people compete in a big giant hall in Donostia, one of the most lovely cities in the Basque Country. So, yes, I would see it. If you turn on the television, you're going to see it. Huh. And if you go someplace publicly, like where I was, every Tuesday night, I would see one of the Bertzolari events happening.
That's just sort of mind-bending, this whole concept.
Yeah.
It's just, it's really remarkable. And, you know, it shouldn't surprise me because As I said earlier, I've always been attracted to Basque culture. I thought maybe it might have been because they've traditionally been sort of freedom fighters, and their uniqueness of their culture and their language. And you mentioned just a few minutes ago about their story, their part in the story of the American West, which is huge.
Yes.
But so I guess it shouldn't surprise me that two people can get up in front of thousands of people and improvise songs in sort of a poetry slam situation.
It is. I would say that the closest thing we have is poetry slam, except that in poetry slam, we still allow people to prepare the work in advance. You know, they write the poem in advance, they memorize it, and then recite it. But here, the people learn a lot of chunks of language, and they can use things, you know, but if you watch Abertzolari, if you had a chance to come to Elko and see these people, or even if you watch, you know, we can watch Basque television online now in the computer world. If you find one to watch, you will notice that when the, I guess you'd call it the moderator, the person who reads the topic out, and they read it very clearly and very slowly, so the competitors are super clear on what it is they're supposed to do. And then you'll watch the first person kind of standing, maybe hands in pockets or at his or her side and rocking a little left and right, and maybe their eyes are sort of tilted to the heavens, and you can see the whirring of the brain machine going as they're trying to figure out what they're going to do. Another thing that makes it hard is, unlike English, a Basque sentence, the end of it physically is the beginning of it in terms of thought. So in English, I can start a sentence, or in French or in Spanish, and I don't really have to know where I'm going when I start. I can think my way through as I talk. But for me, in Basque, and certainly when I talk to other people, even native speakers, you kind of have to know where you're going to get when you start because of the grammar. So I think that would make it even twice as hard to do this in Basque than it would in English.
You mentioned, David, that you and your daughter are performing Basque music. What characterizes Basque music? What's the instrumentation? Tell me about it.
Well, the oldest music, the records we have, there is a flute in a museum in the northern Basque country, which is on the French side of the Pyrenees, that is dated, carbon dated as 27,000 years old. And it is the same physical structure as a contemporary Basque flute that's called a shistu, a kind of three-holed flute, very widely played. And that flute in the museum was made of bird bone. Now, of course, they're made of all kinds of modern composite materials. So that's one of the oldest musics, is that flute, along with a drum. There's also a kind of double reed instrument that's like an oboe. It's another very, very old instrument. The most, what would you say, socially charged, powerful instrument of Basque identity right now is the two-row trikitisha button accordion. And this is kind of funny because we like to think of tradition as something very, very old. But the button accordion did not come to the Basque country until the 1860s with Italian railroad workers. It was introduced and it was immediately taken up by local Basque musicians who loved it for its loudness, its ability to be durable. If you break part of it, it still works. You could play it outdoors at big events and be heard. It became popular immediately. And it wasn't a part of life in much of the Iberian Peninsula, the part that considers itself Spanish. And so it's also identifiable as different and uniquely Basque, even though it's really rather new, you know, 150 years old in a culture that's many, many thousands of years old. Hmm. So that's a big part of it. And in Elko, there will be, you know, I play that kind of button accordion. My daughter plays violin. That was a big part of Basque music. Of course, the violin's also rather newish in the history of musical instruments, 1,000 years old, say. And that's a tradition that was driven out by the button accordion in the late 19th, early 20th century, and now is being reintroduced. So a big part of my mission, as it were, as an American playing Basque music, is to bring back the button accordion and the violin together. So that's what we do a lot of, and I think it's quite beautiful.
And the lyrics of the songs, are they, what are some of the themes? Are they love and death, or are they political, or what are they?
Of course, there are all those things. Now, we're kind of used to, in the United States, we have an entire broad, commercially diffused music that we see on radio and television. And for the most part, that's all pretty much romantic songs. And mostly we would not see Billboard Top 100 hits that were politically charged, that dealt with maybe major global events. That's kind of not it. But in the Basque Country, you would see those lyrics. At the same time, you would see all the kinds of things that are historically a part of any people's music. Songs of joking. There's a really great love song that's mock love, making fun of the looks of the beloved. And then at the end, saying how much you love the person anyway. But, you know, it's clearly a big joke. There are love songs, classic love songs. So I think lyrics can be pretty much a very wide array of subjects in Basque music. And we do some songs, my daughter and I, that make use of all those traditions.
David, before I let you go, I want to talk a little bit about the literature that you've produced. At one time, you were Wyoming's Poet Laureate. And I was fortunate to discover a essay in Sun magazine that you produced, something about red states and blue states.
Oh, yeah. I remember that one.
Really interesting. And you touched a little bit on your art. And I want to ask you, in that essay, you say, literature offers a freedom that is not granted us in normal life. I wondered if that's why you make poetry.
Well, I suspect I would have to admit that that is partially it. As a child, I had what many people would consider a very difficult childhood in terms of the kind of family I was raised in and the relationship I had, especially with my father. And for me, reading as a kid was an escape into worlds that could be better and freer and more beautiful and didn't have the pain of the world that I did live in. So it was always partially escape. You know, for many of us, art allows us to escape from the constraints of our daily lives. At the same time, it allowed me to reintroduce what I thought was beautiful into daily life. And for example, I believe that my experience of reading and writing helped me when it came time to be a parent, to recognize what I wanted to do as a father that would be different from my own father's way of handling his children. So that is a really big, big part of what I'm doing as a writer. And I think many friends I have who write or are musicians who write songs still do see that this is a place where we can, to some degree, make life as we imagine it would be most beautiful to have it.
I found several. That's beautiful. That's really beautiful. I found several of your poems online, and they were very closely observed, very human moments that often had a little moral payoff that wasn't like a grand epiphany. I wonder if you would read a poem for us.
Oh, yeah, sure. Do you have something you would like, or do you want me to just pick something?
Well, let's see. There's the one, I think it was, let's see, Sunday Early Morning or something like that.
Oh, yeah, the one about the boats?
Yes, that's a beautiful
poem. Is that
poem.
The one? Yeah, that might be appropriate because that's a newer poem. That's in my most recent book, just came out last February. And it deals with my daughter, with whom I will be working at Elko. So there's some connection there, too.
Great.
Should I go ahead and read you that one?
Yes, please.
Okay. It's called Sunday Morning Early. My daughter and I paddle red kayaks across the lake. Pulling hard, we slip easily through the water. Far from either shore, it hits me that my daughter is a young woman. And suddenly, everything is a metaphor for how short a time we are granted. The red boats on the blue-black water, the russet and gold of late summer's grasses, the empty sky. We stop and listen to the stillness. I say, it's Sunday, and here we are in the Church of the Out-of-Doors. Then wish I'd kept quiet. That's the trick in life, learning to leave well enough alone. Our boats drift to where the churring of grasshoppers reaches us from the rocky hills, a clap of thunder. I want to say something truer than I love you. I want my daughter to know that through her, I live a life that was closed to me. I paddle up, lean out, and touch her hand. I start to speak. Then stop.
Lesson learned.
we hope. And I think what you notice seems to me really, really insightful. That is, I'm trying to say something as a writer that I think could count for myself and for someone else that may give us pause, and it can be even a very short pause. When you say it's not a big grand epiphany, but there seems to be some small attention or attention paid to some small detail we might not have noticed or might not have said quite as clearly as we'd hoped to, because I think a lot of life is what's on the tip of our tongue. And we struggle, whether we're a writer or just a human being, to actually say what it is we really mean.
And those small realizations get at the very center of the human experience.
That's what I hope.
Yeah. I remember one of my teachers back in the day said, you always think it's at the tips of your fingers, but it's really in the palm of your hand.
Yeah, that's a good one, too.
And I'm going, okay, I think I get it. But, you know, it's taken me a lifetime to get it, and I'm still getting it.
Yeah, I think that's another thing that is really, really interesting. And I've spent a lot of my life working with young people, and I once was, and now I grow to be an older person, and definitely for a kid in school, a lot of kids would see me as very old. And I think it's important for them to know that you just keep kind of seeing the world open before you all the way through. It's not as though you actually get somewhere. You're always getting instead of having got.
Well, you can learn more about the Cowboy Poetry Gathering at nationalcowboypoetrygathering.org. David's website is davidromvet.com. Romvet spelled R-O-M-T-V-E-D-T. We will flip the poetic coin and go now to slam poetry. Meta Sarmiento is a Filipino poet and rapper from Guam. He is a National Poetry Slam semifinalist with Slam Nuba, a TEDx speaker and winner of Spoken Word for the World 2015, where he was flown to Paris to perform during the UN climate negotiations. He is a born teacher capable of motivating ghetto kids and old hippies alike, and he performs tonight and hosts a poetry slam for teens at the Temporary beginning at 6:30. And tomorrow at the Basalt Library, he will offer a free all-ages workshop at 10 a.m. I spoke with Meta yesterday. The kids are the focus, aren't they?
Yeah.
Isn't that the case with a lot of what you do?
Yeah, definitely.
I've noticed that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you really engage with the kids.
Definitely.
Don't you?
I love it.
Is that because somebody engaged with you?
Yeah. Yeah, that's basically how I got started. I was in junior year of my high school, and my English teacher was like, hey, you need to come down and see this performance. I was like, what kind of performance is it? And it turns out it was a spoken word poetry performance. And I had no idea spoken word existed at all, right? Like, I was just oblivious to this type of art. And so the collective that was there, they performed a bunch of poems that really resonated with me in ways that other poets couldn't, other poets that we've studied in class. And from that point, I started hitting the poetry slams in Guam, and the organizers really started guiding me and mentoring me and sort of helping me find my voice, right, and helping me decide what I would use my voice for. So I think a lot of the reason why I work with the youth so much is because I'm sort of reciprocating that, right, and I understand the power of good guidance and good mentorship. Not that I'm perfect, but.
Well, I watched the video of your performance of Watch Your Mouth.
Yeah.
And it brought tears to my eyes.
Wow, that means so much.
And it wasn't the only one. I spent 2 hours today looking at videos of you reading your poems. And every single one of them, I cried.
Thank you so much.
How do you do that?
I don't know. First off, it's always funny to hear someone say, like, oh, yeah, your poem kind of made me cry. Because I'm like, I'm sorry. But,
no,
but I'm also not sorry because it happened. I think that, you know, as a poet, as a writer, it took me a long time to figure it out, but I think that I really just care about human connection, right? There's a lot of politics involved in my work. There's a lot of identity in my work, but at the end of the day, it's really about forming a connection with somebody and helping them through whatever they're going through and really just trying to inspire them about you know, hoping that my personal transformations inspired personal transformations for themselves. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just stay real. I guess that's the how-to, is stay real in your poetry and don't sacrifice truth for technique too much.
And did that come to you along the way? Did you learn that, or did somebody impress that upon you?
I think being exposed to the national poetry scene and international poetry scene kind of helped me understand that, because growing up in Guam, you're so far away from everything, right? And when you leave the island and you start to experience these new poets and new stories and new voices, you start to see things differently, and your perspective deepens and widens. And I think it was that experience that made me sort of believe in this idea that, you know, I need to focus a lot more on just connecting instead of being a flashy poet on the microphone. Because I think a lot of young poets, when they first start out, it's all about being clever and being witty on the microphone, and not so much about writing truth and connecting to people.
Huh. Yeah. So is there, how did you learn that?
Ah, man.
You mentioned that you learned it by being exposed to the outer world out there in poetry. But how did that get in there?
I think one of the most meaningful experiences for me at a young age was I performed at my old high school, right? And after my performance, I performed this poem called Riot, and it kind of chronicled my gang affiliation and how I almost died and how I had to wake up and I had to change my life around. And at that moment, this kid came up to me and he said, "Bro, I just want to thank you. You changed my life." And I think those interactions is what helped me really solidify this idea that, wow, if I really focus on connecting to people like this, I can actually reach people and change their lives. So seeing that and being a part of that kind of change right in front of you personally, I think that's what helped me like really hold on to that, and it just completely ingrained it in my mind.
It sounds like you had a pretty remarkable family too. I'm thinking of the anecdote that I came across where at one point a policeman brought you to your mother, and he said, "Do you recognize this boy?" And she said, "No, I do not recognize him."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh my God, you know, it's like I would not have had the wisdom to think of that in that moment. Right. So that tells me a lot about your mother.
My mom, man, she's such a strong woman. So that anecdote comes from my poem called Mama's Boy, which I might perform. I think a lot of my strength and my own wisdom and my upbringing is due to a lot of the brave brown women in my life, like my mom and my older sister and the woman in my community as well. She was just, you know, being herself and being real in that moment, and told the police officer, "No, that's not my son. Like, I don't know that person." She had just experienced enough, right? All of the crazy things that I was doing in the street. And my dad followed up right behind her and said, "No, that's our son. That's, come here."
Right. But it was her way of saying, boom, get it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And and presumably you did.
I did. I definitely did. It was such a clear message. Like, I didn't know up until that point how much I loved my mom and my family, until for the first time it felt like they didn't want me anymore. And that's what kind of just snapped everything into perspective and was like, okay, wow, I need to really reevaluate my life. And I'm like 15, 14 at this moment. So it's just, I didn't have the vocabulary at that time to articulate how it was feeling, but I knew that I had just messed up so bad that my own mom doesn't want me. Like, that's, you hear stories about that and you always tell yourself, I never want to be that kid. And then you end up being that kid.
How about that? Yeah. Tell me about Guam.
Yeah.
Did American culture permeate into Guam? Mm-hmm. Hip hop, all of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Guam is a unincorporated territory of the United States. It's a very small island. It's like 6 miles wide and 7 miles long. And so a lot of what everyone's into kind of just spreads throughout the island really quickly. And our schools are modeled after the United States education curriculum. So everything that the States is doing, we're doing as well. So yeah, a lot of like the subcultures from the States found their way to Guam. Hip hop, poetry, obviously, and a whole bunch of other things, like just the urban culture itself definitely found its way into Guam. And it makes it a really interesting place to live because you're literally caught between the street and the jungle, but also metaphorically. So you have these really urban subcultures in your face, but then you're also an islander, and then you have the islander culture mixed in with that. So it's this constant back and forth, a dance almost between Americanized culture and the Pacific Islander culture.
Interesting. And yet, you went to college and got an MFA, didn't you?
An MA in teaching, yeah.
Oh, okay. How did you get off the urban track onto that track? How did that happen for you?
I feel like a lot of what I do, it's so like just intermixed, right? Like I don't think that I completely left behind the urban culture, right? Because like that's what raised me. Like I love hip hop. I love the streets. At the core of my being, I'm still really gritty, you know? But I also see the value in bringing a person who has those experiences into the classroom, right? I always tell people, like, what happens when the gangster becomes a scholar? A lot of really amazing things can happen because that person is now a bridge between snobby academia and the homies in the streets, right? And so there's a lot of building that can happen between this person, and that person can become a bridge. And so the reason I got my bachelor's in English literature and my master's in teaching is because I wanted to do just that. I wanted to go back into my communities. I wanted to go back to work with the same kids that are going through the same problems that I was going through and help them through it all.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow, that's really interesting. You know, that gives you a lot of credibility in a couple of different worlds.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty interesting,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah. You know, it's why a white boy like me can appreciate what you do, partly, aside from the truth of you're speaking.
Right.
But, and it's also apparent to the gangbanger in that Watch Your Mouth poem that you wrote. He thought you were effing great.
Right. Exactly.
So, you know, we both think you're great.
Right.
Go figure.
Yeah.
An old hippie and a gangbanger both love you.
Right.
How does that happen? That's just amazing.
Connection. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, it's obvious to me that you've been empowered. And
definitely.
You're still being empowered.
Definitely.
And it's all about, for you, empowerment. And not only is it important to you to be yourself empowered, but to empower others along the way.
Yeah, that's really at the end of the day, man. Like the biggest hope, right, from my work is to just inspire that kind of empowerment. Yeah.
So you got a degree. You moved away from Guam to Denver.
Yeah.
Why Denver?
You know, I've traveled a lot for both poetry and hip hop. I've been to L.A., been to New York, all the other major cities that people would expect me to have settled in. And I think at this point in my career, I'm just not ready to be in that kind of crazy. And I think Denver just has a really beautiful balance between the urban and sort of maybe rural, I'd like to say. I can be inside of the city doing a lot of this urban art. And when I'm feeling overwhelmed, I can get in a car and just drive up to the mountains and camp by Turquoise Lake, you know? Like, I can just decompress. That, and I've really admired a lot of the Denver poets for a very long time. Since I started back in junior year of my high school, I was already watching Denver poets on YouTube, and that's like the beginning of spoken words explosion into the internet. So like poets like Ken Arkind and Panama, there were two poets that I really looked up to. So I just figured, yeah, maybe I should, you know, go to Denver and see what happens. And I also knew that I would stick out, for better or for worse, because there aren't too many API poets in Denver.
API?
Asian Pacific Islander.
Oh.
Right. So there's not a lot of Asian Pacific Islander poets doing this kind of work. And if there are, they're sort of on the fringes and on the periphery of the work. So I figured, yeah, I should just go plow through to the middle and see what happens.
And you're part of the collective down there, what's it called?
Slam Nuba.
Yes.
We could head.
Tell me about that organization.
Yeah, so Slam Nuba, they are one of Denver's main Poetry Collectives. They're an organization as well. And they host workshops, they host poetry slams for the community. And they have been a very respected slam team for years. So that's one reason why I wanted to get involved with Slam Nuba. And they also have a lot of love for just black poets and poets of color. So I decided to just step into that scene and see what happened.
Huh. Yeah. And is there a place where a lot of the performances take place?
Yeah, so right now a lot of Slam Nuba events are happening at Brother Jeff's Cultural Center, which is in the Five Points.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's a really cool space. There's art everywhere, and it just feels so communal. When you walk in there, it just feels like a really good community.
One of the turning points in your career so far mm-hmm. has been your entrance into a contest. Mm. What was spoken?
Yeah.
Tell me more about that.
Yeah. So I entered Spoken Word for the World in 2015. It was hosted by Global Call for Climate Action. And basically, they teamed up with this powerful Marshallese poet by the name of Cassie Jenil Kijener. The Marshalls are a chain of islands in the Pacific that are being affected by the rising tides. The water is literally rising. It's taking their land. And so she had the opportunity to speak at the United Nations, I think a couple years prior to this particular contest, and she got to speak in the main forum, so all of the UN members were in there, and her video went viral. So this organization teamed up with her to host this new contest, and what they were looking for were poets who had poetry surrounding the issue of climate change and environmental justice. So the process was really awesome. You recorded the video of yourself, you uploaded it, and then it was sort of like the top batch of poets would get accepted, and then there would be votes to see who would garner the most attention and whatnot. So I ended up being selected as one of the winners, and it was amazing because all the winners were from the Pacific or were tied to the Pacific.
Interesting.
Yeah, but we were from different places in the world. So Eunice was from Australia, Issa and Teresa were from the Bay Area. Right. And I was living in Guam. So we were so separated, but so connected at the same time. And for me, going to Paris, that was a prize. We were flown to Paris to perform poetry at the United Nations climate negotiations.
Ooh.
Yeah. Wow. So it was a really interesting experience, especially because it was 2 weeks after the terrorist bombings. So it was a really weird time in Paris. There was just so much tension everywhere. But learning from these amazing, powerful women who were a bit further on in their careers was just an amazing thing for me. And also being able to bring stories of our people into spaces that would normally marginalize our voices, would push us aside and say, we don't want to hear it, right? We were able to be center stage and tell the stories of the Pacific and tell the stories of indigenous peoples who are being affected by climate change. Because I think a lot of times we talk about climate change, there's a lot of science in it. And so a lot of people get turned off, right? Because they don't understand scientific jargon and whatnot. So our job was to put narration to the science. And the CEO of 350.org said, the poets that are here today are proof of our physics. And I was just like, are you a poet? Like, that was really poetic. Yeah. It was just a really amazing time being able to bring voices and stories of our region surrounding climate change.
And the story you brought to the table was a weird
haze.
Mist or haze.
Yeah.
Was that from fires across the... What was that
yeah.
from?
Yeah. So there were fires in Indonesia and in Papua New Guinea. And the smoke was affecting the weather patterns or whatnot. And so it was traveling across the ocean and ending up in Guam. So it was beautiful. There's like this beautiful mist, like this haze. But it was really bad for us because it was getting into our lungs, right? It's technically smoke, right? We were breathing that for about an entire week. It was just blanketing the island. And I got sick from it. So I decided to write a poem about that, and that's the poem I entered. And I was still sick when I entered the contest. So if you look back to the video, like, I sound sick, I'm congested, and stuff like that. So it was a crazy experience.
Have a lot of doors open for you since you won that prize?
I wouldn't say a lot as far as quantity goes, But I think a lot of doors with quality, right? A lot of people who are extremely interested in this kind of work have been paying attention a lot more. Uh-huh. And, you know, it definitely adds to my prestige as a poet from a business standpoint, right? Like, oh, yeah, this guy won this and went to the UN. So right. That's definitely opening up for me.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you also have a CD that you've produced.
Yeah, yeah. I put out an album recently, yeah.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, so Apartment 207 is the name of the album. I wrote the entire album when I first moved to Denver in Apartment 207. So it was the first unit I had ever lived in Denver. And mind you, this is my first time leaving home, period, for good. So it was a really big step for me, and I was just going through a lot of self-doubt and just emotional turmoil, like, should I keep doing this? Maybe I should move back home. And I decided not to, and writing this album kind of helped me through all that confusion. So if anybody's chasing something bigger than themselves, which I think a lot of people are, then they'll understand the fear and the doubt and the triumph in the album. Uh-huh. And if you're into rap, then you're definitely going to like it.
Yeah. Well, I watched the videos that you have on your website, mm-hmm. Based on that, three or four of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, really good stuff.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I would call it conscious hip-hop.
Yeah, a lot of people have labeled it conscious hip-hop,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, it's not gangster rap.
Definitely not gangster rap by any means, yeah.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. good. Will you do a poem or two for us, please?
I can definitely do a poem or two.
Thank you.
Yeah. What kind of poems do you guys want to hear?
Rise out of my seat poem, squirm into the dent in the seat poems.
You want me to do Mama's Boy since we talked about it?
I'd love it.
Yeah? Okay, yeah, I can do that.
If you're up for it.
Yeah.
If you just joined the program, we're talking to Meta Sarmiento, slam poet from Guam, visiting our valley, and we'll get to why in a few minutes, but here's some poetry from Meta.
My homeboys cracked a joke once about a gang rape. And I'm glad my older sister taught me the weight of the word no. Told me that before I ask what it takes to be a man, I should ask what it takes to be a woman. Brave brown women have always been my searchlight. They love like a life raft, carry the undeserving, move us until gratitude learns to catch a breath. And how do I repay this rescue? I'm learning to dismantle the crown I was born with, to walk away from the seat I was promised, the one reserved for the head of the household, the hungry breadwinner, me, this brown boy blood lined with a matriarch's power once. But the echo of patriarchy is deep and loud, and the men who conquered the world left no space for my softening. But Mom teaches me that instinct tells our grip to reach for a mother's breast before it hungers for the knife. That before a storm becomes a cutting wind, it starts as a warm ocean. Brave brown women have always been my harbor, even after all of my destroying. And I don't want to leave any more wrecks. I don't want to be the threat that forces prayer. I'm sorry, I still got to tell my homies that joking of rape is killing the bodies that nurture us. I'm sorry, I still have to sit them down and explain to them feminism isn't women simply hating men. Feminism is safe zone for women to heal without our bloody hands. It's a story without men as the main character. Their job isn't to script us a role in it. Our role is to interrogate our love affair with domination. Strip the guns, homie. Melt the bullets and admit. Blood scares us as much as a thought of losing our mothers. I forget when I stopped being a mama's boy. When I told Mom stop holding my hand in public. When I stopped showing any love at all because the hood said to be a weapon. Brass knuckles don't smile. Triggers ain't a church choir. We don't sing. We scream till silence is the only sound left. I remember cops taking me home instead of to the precinct. Knocking on my front door and asking, "Ma'am, is this your son?" And Mom saying, "No, I don't know that boy." And it was the first step toward tears I forgot I was allowed to have. A glimpse of the shoreline that called for my return. And I know the trek is long. Unlearning the violence I inherited requires a knife as tough as a mother's backbone. But I am ready for the cutting, for the surgery the storm gives the cliffside. because I want to be a brave brown man who can love like a brave brown woman too.
Wow. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for allowing me to perform that poem.
You're so welcome. That's really impressive. What did your mom think? Have you recited that to her?
I haven't yet. She's visiting in the summer, though. So
has she seen the video, maybe?
She hasn't, no. She has no idea it exists. So.
Oh, you should give it to her on Mother's Day.
That would be amazing.
Yes.
Yeah, actually, that would
Holy
be tight.
Cow.
That would be an extremely emotional
yes,
Mother's Day gift. No?
Holy cow. Can you imagine? That is really cool. Huh. How about one more?
Yeah, sure.
Please.
Yeah. Let me read one from my book. Maybe not one that's as long.
And this book will be for sale at the Poetry Slam on Friday night.
Tie your shoes, kid.
So I'll read a shorty from my book. It's called The Lessons in Departures. Accept your own apologies. Love ends with forgiveness. Sometimes home is a body and a voice. Photographs are proof I am conquering my insecurities. Going to bed after laughing helps me sleep better. My insomnia is jealous of my dreams. My passion has taken me farther than any of my fears have. The only direction I wish to travel is forward, always. Loneliness is an honest mirror. They'll demand your love. You're not obligated to give it. An expensive drink is still just cheap therapy. The size of a house does not dictate how much happiness it can hold. A healthy bird must leave its mother's nest. Time is not the enemy. My lack of patience is. Someone else's success is not my failure. My heart deserves to smile after all it has survived.
Meta Sarmiento. Yeah.
Thank you.
How do you find these remarkable people, Alia Howe? And thank you for dropping them into my midst.
I sort of want to say the divine has a hand in this because really, I knew I wanted to have a host when I was asked to produce the first poetry slam at the Temporary in Willits, that I wanted to have a really imbued, embedded in the spoken word, in the poetry slam movement, to come and host this, to hold this community into what this can really be. And I just do not have time in poetry slams. And so I began asking around, and some people were busy. And then I had Nicole Haag up here sharing a story from Denver. And I said, hey, you know anyone who'd be interested in hosting the Poetry Slam? And she gave me two names. And Meta responded, followed up, and I was just in trust and in delight and surprise as I began to research and exchange communications with Meta. It's been smooth. It's been effortless. And I'm really excited. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, not only are you hosting the Poetry Slam, Meta, but you're doing several workshops in local schools and libraries.
Yep.
Which one of you would like to talk about that?
Let me just talk about the events. The main event is Friday at the Temporary. Doors open at 6 p.m. and the Poetry Slam will start at 6:30 p.m. And this is $8 if... Actually, sorry, the ticket line closed late on Thursday night. So actually, you can't get tickets online anymore. You'll just be able to buy them on the door. But the Poetry Slam is going to feature youth poets from the group called First Word, and then poets from the Aspen Poets Society, from the Poetry Market, and all ages. So I'm rather excited in watching how Meta handles this age range. Before the Poetry Slam, at 4 o'clock, there's a kids' workshop. What did you call the workshop, Meta? Something about superheroes.
Yes, yes. So we're dubbing it the Superhero Kids Workshop.
Yeah.
And that is at 4 o'clock and at the Temporary as well. And then on Saturday at 10:30 a.m. till 12:30 p.m. at the Basalt Regional Library, Meta is hosting another workshop, which is about body image.
Yes, yeah.
And this is free, and it is hosted by the Basalt Regional Library in their outreach in supporting locals having an experience of poetry writing, of storytelling. And I'm really thrilled when I told them that Meta was coming on, that they just jumped in to host that. So a big shout out to Basalt Library. And then also a huge shout out to Aspen Words, who has been part of supporting Meta coming out here. We couldn't have done it without Aspen Words.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
And of course, the Temporary in saying, let's have it here.
So bridging communities.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds Love like it. That's your specialization.
That's what I'm trying to do.
That's what you're good at. Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you for joining us on KDNK.
Thank you so much for having me.
I really appreciate you coming in. And Alia?
Thank you, Luke. Thank you.
Meta has his own YouTube channel, and I highly recommend that you check those videos out. If they don't move or inspire you, you are a rock, not a human being. Well, hey, that's going to do it for today's Express Yourself. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. Two different worlds of poetry with a lot of similarities. Enjoy the snow this weekend, and please remember to go out there and express yourself.